All the money in the world couldn't even amount to a teaspoon of honey when it melt your mouth. That's right. It's the Locks and Mariah's. You checking us out? You know the deal. A few mil every time she come out. With her blowing and us flowing, it ain't nothing else left to talk about but a whole lot of dough.
And every coming to fair, we there. Keeping your hands in the air like you just don't care. Don't be a liar, would you change your attire? Get a farm like Hillshire with a honey like Mariah. Escape to the ranch and ride a horse, then come back to the city, pushing the Rolls Royce.
Oh, there we go. Hello, everyone. Thank you so, so much for coming. As everyone knows, this is like my first live show. Some of these faces are like super familiar, some of them aren't. I'm really glad that all of you guys are here. I have to admit, I'm like a little bit nervous, but kind of got to get over it now. My podcast really started, obviously, from a conversation and an idea that I had with a friend. And a week later, I was like recording my first episode, like off of my laptop in my bedroom with Hunter Harris, who is here right now and now works for New York Magazine for Vulture. And in the background, you could hear the fan humming because it was in the thick of the summer, and so ever since then, I've put out 53 episodes of my podcast. It's something I'm super proud of. Thank you. And it really just started from wanting to create a space for people to shout out the things and the places that they enjoy. I often feel like we live in this time where it's like, it's so much cooler to be about the things that you think are distasteful than to shout out the things that you really love. And so I wanted to get people on my podcast who have like maintained their optimism in some way and also give them a platform to talk about the stuff that they thought was really cool. And so with that being said, I am really excited to have Sopan Deb here with me. He's a culture writer for the New York Times, and he writes about the intersection of politics and culture. And before that, he was actually on the campaign trail covering Trump. So we're going to talk about his personal experience doing that and a little bit in some funny ways. And so was also at CBS. He has worked for the Boston Globe, for Al Jazeera, for NBC. The funny thing is that I actually met Sopan at a Friendsgiving, which is probably like one of the most New York things you could ever do, a Friendsgiving. And so before we actually get into our conversation, not only is Sopan a writer and a journalist, but he also is a pianist, which I think is kind of cool. Does anyone else like play an instrument? I played the violin. What did you play, Manushka? I didn't know that. The piano. The piano? Okay, anyone else?
Piano guitar.
Okay. Oh, here we go.
Trumpet.
Kayla, did you ever have your hand raised?
Yeah, I played the clarinet.
You played the clarinet. Joy? The guitar?
The violin.
The violin? I didn't even know that. I played the drums. See, it's just amazing. Like, what? I should ask about sports next. No. But I don't know. I played the violin from like 5 until I was 18, and I could still play now. But, you know, I just think it's really cool to kind of keep up these things. So in addition to the piano, I kind of got sidetracked. Sopan is also a stand-up comic, which is something he practices. And so I asked him if he would do some stand-up before we got started. And so I'm going to bring up Sopan. And let's give him a round of applause.
Wow. How's everybody? Wow, this is cool. This is cool. Darian asked me to do stand-up, and I was like, well, hold on, let me check. And I Googled the Ludlow House, and it said Mediterranean Restaurant. And I was like, yes, of course, it's every comic's dream to perform at a Mediterranean restaurant. So, of course, I'm going to... This is really exciting. I've been doing comedy since my mid-20s. I'm in my late 20s now, so about 15 years. And I've never done stand-up for a podcast before. So my hope is that if my jokes aren't funny, the people that are listening to this are assuming that I have really funny facial expressions. That's like my hope here. Is everybody here from New York, I assume? Because otherwise, no, where are you guys from?
Maryland.
Okay, so you came up just to listen to me tell you jokes? Oh, okay, all right. So is anyone, did anyone commute here from outside of New York? Okay, where are you, where did you come in from? D.C., okay, so no one, okay, but is anyone here, like, was anyone born outside of this country? I just want to get a sense of what jokes I can make that won't offend anybody. Where were you born? Dominica. I don't have any Dominican Republic jokes, so I think we're okay. I think we're okay. Yeah, no, my name is Sopan. I have not forgiven my parents for that yet. For a long time, I thought Sopan was short for something, and my parents just got lazy. Like, they forgot to figure out what it was short for. Like, they were like, okay, Sopan, is that lunch? And then they just forgot. And I found out recently that, like, Sopan actually means stairs in Hindi. Like, and I don't know if you guys are like me, when I see stairs, I, like, feel miserable. Like, they couldn't name me after something cool like escalators or elevator. It had to be stairs. I just found that, I would have settled for Dennis or, like, Bob, you know? But, yeah, so that is my name. Name jokes go over really well on podcasts, guys. Yeah, so I write for the failing New York Times. That always gets a laugh, and I don't know why. You guys really reward incompetence, and I just don't understand why. And it's true, I actually did cover the Trump campaign. I was on the road with him for almost 2 years. I went to hundreds of rallies, more than 40 states with Donald Trump. He actually hate tweeted me. This is true. If you can actually Google this. He tweeted that I was third rate, dishonest, incompetent, and said I should be fired. And then my mother, this is true, my mother called me the next day and said, I'm running for president. And I said, Mom, what are you talking about? She goes, I've insulted you much better than Trump has my whole life. No, and a lot of the questions, one of the questions I always get about covering Trump is like, were his supporters racist? And this is the God's honest truth. And when I say gods, I mean that literally because I'm Hindu. The God's honest truth is like, the vast, vast majority of Trump supporters were actually very nice to me and actually were very warm and actually wanted to have their voices heard. But there were a couple incidents. And one of them was that I'll never forget was when I was in Reno. Anyone here ever been to Reno? Now, this is like a pretty liberal New York City crowd. No one here has been to Reno, like if we're being honest here. I went to Reno and there were long lines outside of the arena. And Trump always had these long lines for his rallies. And I was taking pictures of the line, and this older white gentleman who's wearing a Vietnam shirt with patches and stuff on it, he goes to me, hey, what are you doing? Shooting photos for ISIS? And I'm like, I thought I misheard him, so I just kind of kept doing my thing. And he said it again, this time louder for everyone to hear. Hey, what are you doing? Shooting photos for ISIS? And my jaw dropped again. How did he know? As you know, we in ISIS have spent years trying to infiltrate the U.S. with jihadist photographers. And Sherlock Holmes over here cracked the case in 2 minutes. I found that very bizarre. I'm what's called a whitewashed Indian. I didn't even hit the punchline, and front row is laughing already. That's fantastic. I love that. I'm what's called a whitewashed Indian, and the definition of a whitewashed Indian depends on who you talk to. Like, if you ask a Native American Indian what it means to be whitewashed, it means having your land stolen from you, and then being subjugated for centuries, and then being compensated for it with alcoholism and casinos. You ask a South Asian Indian like me what it means to be whitewashed, it means having gotten to see a Dave Matthews Band concert. Okay, no one here has seen Dave Matthews Band, really? Seriously? Come on now. Actually, I've been to 30 Dave Matthews Band concerts. Did someone say, oh no? Who said that? Yeah, someone raises their hand. Yeah, I said that. What are you doing at 30? This is actually true. I set the record for Indians attending Dave Matthews Band concerts. I set the record at 2. That's the punchline, guys. Help me here. Help me. I started, I actually, you know, I'm whitewashed enough that I actually have mostly dated white women in my life. And it's not because I'm racist, okay? I know why you might think that. It's more because I know what it takes to get ahead. I really want a mixed baby. Okay, I want a baby that is brown enough to get financial aid to college, but like white enough to get promoted in the job afterwards. That's the joke, guys. Seriously, man, help me here. No, it's true. And actually, one of the tough things about dating white women is that I feel like I have to brown-splain things to them a lot. Like, you know, like they'll be like, why haven't I met your parents yet? I'm like, one does not simply walk into Mordor. And then they'll be like, okay, but like your parents didn't date. No, my parents did not date. Their parents dated on their behalf. This is a brutal crowd. Hello, everybody. I could use like a warm-up act right now, like that. And I started, I recently started dating somebody, and I realized that I'm the romantic in the relationship. And I realized this recently because last week, you know, I stayed over at her place, and I woke up, and I was going to go to work, but I looked at her, and she looked wonderful and beautiful, and I like looked at her in a fit of passion and started grabbing her and kissing her. As we're making out, she stops, and she goes, take your pants off. And I'm like, oh, okay. And my loins are girded, right? And I... And she, like, rips my pants off and, like, starts backing away. And I'm like, oh. And then she goes, your pants are wrinkled. I'm going to wrinkle them so you can go to work. And that's when I realized I'm married now.
I just want to say I don't have that kind of courage.
Well, after tonight, I won't.
Okay, here's actually my first question before we even dive into anything. How did you even decide that you wanted to start doing stand-up?
Oh,
because I feel like I'm funny and I can do it, but I don't actually think
I felt like I was funny, and then I came in here tonight. No. It was about 4 or 5 years ago. Actually, literally, this is what happened. My college girlfriend broke up with me, and I was like, "What do sad people do? We start doing comedy." And so I started doing improv for a couple years. That was like 6 years ago. And then I started doing stand-up. And I loved it because it allowed me to have a voice. Mm-hmm. It was therapeutic. I felt like I had things I wanted to get off my chest.
Yeah.
Whether it was about being Indian or whether it was about being about my life or about my identity. Mm-hmm. And it was, and there's a real thrill that comes with making people laugh. Mm. There's a real thrill that comes with making people laugh with something that you've constructed, with something that you've written. Mm. And there are days when you, absolutely kill it, and it's like a high unlike anything that you will ever do in your life. And that's why I love it, and that's why I do it, and it's really great. And frankly, it's also a form of therapy. I'll be honest with you.
Yeah.
It's really a wonderful way of challenging yourself and like shutting off the voice in your head that's like, oh, you can't do this. Oh, that's not creative.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. And then you just get to like stand in front of a crowd and say stuff that at least you think is funny, and then the thrill is that hopefully other people will too.
Yeah. Well, the thing about a lot of stand-ups will tell you that it's not like you can kill on a Monday and bomb on a Tuesday. You know, you have to have
the same jokes.
Yo, totally. Oh, that's happened. You know, you have to have supreme confidence in yourself, and you have to have supreme confidence at least while you're on stage. You can walk off and be like, "Well, that was terrible."
Yeah.
You know, but there's a reason that, for example, Jerry Seinfeld. Jerry Seinfeld tells the same jokes. Like he has half of his set is the same every single year he goes on tour, whereas you know there are guys like Chris Rock and Louis C.K. that do entirely new sets every single year. And that's hard. That's something that I don't know if I can do. You know, I try to do like half of my old stuff and half new stuff.
Yeah.
But you're praying that they think it's funny, then you walk on stage and then you're just telling them what is funny. And that's the best piece of comedy advice I ever received, which is you're not trying to make the audience laugh, you are telling them what is funny.
Huh. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. I never thought
By the way, what I just did was really funny. Just to clarify, let me just tell you guys.
Okay, cool. I know. I mean, I actually think it's interesting to actually like do stand up and and then to hear people talk about why they actually do it, because I feel like as someone who's listening to it, it's like I can make assumptions about you based off of what I heard, mm-hmm. and what I think you believe.
Sure.
But then you talk to that person, it's like, oh, maybe this is like new material or something they were trying, or I don't know, they wanted to get the audience on an edge in some way.
Yeah, sure. There are
not really. He goes
No. There are comics that actually like go out of their way to be edgy, mm-hmm. and that's not what I try to do. But if my material happens to be edgy, great. If not, that's just not what I try to do, though.
Yeah.
I think if you try to be edgy in any field, you fail. What you're trying to do is be original, and if it happens to be edgy, that's great.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. So let's get into, you know.
I like that she like spent the first couple questions justifying why she had me do that before.
No.
This is like, so why do you do that exactly? What was that about?
Okay, so I'm going to act like you didn't say that. So as I already explained, you know, I do this because I want to give people a platform to, number one, tell their stories in a specific way. I used to hate talking about career stuff on my podcast because I felt like, I don't know. I'm already burnt out, number one. Number two.
How old are you?
I'm 26.
Okay. You have some time left, just so you know.
Time, but I'm already like over everything I want to spend my life on.
Right, yeah, yeah.
Anyways, I know that what I learned is, as I continue to do this, is like that's what people really want to hear about, is we're fascinated with how people climb a ladder in some way or don't, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so that always seems to be the core of what I do. But the first question I always ask everyone is, I want to know how you grew up. I want to know what life was like for you, because I often find that you could go your entire life doing something, but
sure.
looking back at the core of who you were as a little kid, you'll find little remnants of like, damn, I'm finally enjoying life, and this is what it was like.
My parents are born in India.
What part of India?
I believe in Calcutta. They were arranged to get married, and they had a terrible marriage. And that's kind of a rare thing in arranged marriages, because usually, like, they're not about love. They're transactional, in essence. And the love hopefully comes later. If it doesn't, you still have some kids, and that's how it is. But with my parents, it's the very rare arranged marriage that was such a bad match that it just didn't work. So they got divorced when I was in high school. And I grew up in a very, very white town called Howell, New Jersey, which is right near Point Pleasant, right near where the Jersey Shore was filmed. We had a woo for Point Pleasant. All right. Excellent. So I was surrounded by... So I'm bilingual. But I was surrounded by a lot of what is, in essence, white culture. And so, which explains a lot of the Dave Matthews Band attendance, you know? I grew up, like, you know, I understand I'm Bengali, I understand the Bengali culture, I understand the Hindu culture. But because of my parents' divorce, I kind of rejected it. Even though I'm bilingual, I kind of was like, well, you know, if they were Catholics, they wouldn't have been arranged to get married, and they wouldn't have gotten divorced, and they wouldn't have, you know. And I kind of went away from it. And that was, I think I'm kind of rare in that respect, because a lot of Indian friends that I have are very much immersed in it. You know, they want to have a big Indian wedding. They go to India every year. I've never been to India. My dad moved to India when I was 18, 19 years old. That was 10 years ago.
So he moved back.
He moved back after my parents got divorced, and I have not been to India. And so it's I have this like Indian identity, but it's also like partially rejection of that identity, mm-hmm. which is something that I've struggled with my whole life. And now I've come to accept it a little more as I've gotten older, and I've realized it's a little bit more important to me than I've realized. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I went to college to be a journalist. Growing up, I loved basketball. I still love basketball. I play in multiple teams. My dad, growing up, didn't know the rules of basketball. Didn't even know what basketball was. Whereas other, you know, white kids' parents are playing catch with them, right? They're playing, you know, they're coaching their little league teams.
So how did you cope with that, though? What was your way of going about trying stuff that wasn't even, like, your parents weren't even encouraging you?
Yeah, no, they weren't. I mean, my parents, you know... The first time I did stand-up, which was, I think, in 2011, 2012, my dad calls me from India, and he says, "Son, what are you doing today?" And I said, "Dad, I'm doing stand-up comedy." He says, "Oh, what's stand-up comedy?" I said, "Oh, Dad, it's when someone stands on stage and tells you jokes." This is what he does. Next topic. And so, like, no, my parents never encouraged me to do, because when you're, you know the stereotype, when you're Indian or you're Asian, you're expected to be a doctor or an engineer. That's what you're expected to be. And I just always rejected that. How did I cope with that? I just kind of rejected my brownness. And for better or for worse, that's what happened. And even though I'm bilingual, and even though there are things about it that I do love, I just kind of grew up and I was like, I want to be able to be a journalist, or I want to be able to be a comedian or an actor or a pianist and not disappoint my parents. Because I think being Asian or being Indian or whatever, I think those are one of the few cultures where not pursuing that route that they want you to pursue is a level of disappointment. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, oh, we're disappointed in you for pursuing that.
Yeah.
You know, and I always just kind of was like, that's not for me.
Yeah.
And that's simplifying it, I think, on my part, and I fully accept that. But that just was always, that always kind of rubbed me the wrong way. And that also, but I've also known many Indian performers and Indians that pursue journalism whose parents were very encouraging, who are very proud of them. And it just depends on who, so that was just the personal experience that I had.
I'm interested to know, though, like, as you were kind of like rejecting that brownness, what about the other people around you who you went to school with in your town? Were they, do you feel like they were reminding you of that in some ways?
I was the only Indian in my graduating class, mm-hmm. and we had a high school of 2,600 kids. We had 460 kids in my high school in my senior class. It's not that they were like rejecting or encouraging, or I just related to them, mm-hmm. because I grew up around kind of a white culture, and so that's just, I just never like looked at skin color in any way. It just never occurred to me. And now that I'm a little bit older, and now that, I say like older, like I'm 29, I'm not like decrepit or anything, but I now like am circling back and trying to find a little bit more of that world, mm-hmm. because I realize now that it's a little bit more important to me than I think I ever realized. But still, it's still something I definitely struggle with, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and I think like that honesty is good, because I think one thing for me too is like I grew up in white communities and white environments, and now looking back, it was like I feel like I had great friends and people who made me feel comfortable in being who I am, but it was also rooted back to like my parents always letting me know that I was good enough, right? Mm-hmm. But then sometimes when you go back and you'll realize like some of like the nuanced racism that has like happened to you, and then you'll go, well, that wasn't right, but you weren't aware of it at that moment.
Yes, I will tell a story from covering. Oh, I'm not holding the mic correctly. Sorry. Oh, sorry. Okay. One thing I will say. I was covering the Trump campaign, and some of you might know this because it got a decent amount of publicity. In March of 2016, which was about a year and 3 months ago, I was arrested covering a rally. And my dad and I don't know each other that well. He lives in India. We talk, once every couple weeks. And he, growing up, didn't understand my world. I didn't understand his world. So it always caused a little bit of a friction. And he certainly didn't understand what I did covering the campaign. It's just not something he would understand, living in India. And, So Trump, you might remember, was supposed to have a rally in Chicago. And Chicago was never a good area for him. There were massive, massive protests. And what ends up happening is, outside of the rally, there are thousands and thousands of protesters. And Trump cancels the rally about a half hour before it was supposed to start. And pandemonium breaks out. Fights between Trump supporters and fights, and protesters, and spills out onto the streets. And I'm out there with my camera. I'm shooting the whole thing. And at one point, what happens is, out of nowhere, multiple Chicago police officers grab me from behind, throw me to the ground, and arrest me. And Fox News actually carried my arrest live, and this ended up saving my life, which I think if Fox knew that, they wouldn't have run the arrest live. But, what ended up happening is, while I am, I guess, in custody, they charged me with resisting arrest, and the reason I was able to, you know, they dropped the charges is because the video clearly showed that I wasn't doing anything. But while I am in custody, this news is kind of spreading. But at the end of the night, I get released after a couple hours. I'm just tired. My phone is blowing up, and I just don't want to deal with anything. I don't want to deal with, you know, I got a lot of media reporters calling. Can I find out what happened? And I just didn't want. I told my bosses what happened, and, you know, we had, like, a statement out, and I just wanted to go to bed. So I go to bed, and I forgot to tell my family what happened.
Oh, my God.
So yeah. And not because, you know, it was just, like, 3 in the morning, and I was like, I will deal with the rest. I just wanted to go to sleep. It was a long night. The next morning, my dad calls me. And I thought it was one of his biweekly, you know, calls. And I'm like, I pick up the phone. He goes, what happened? And I'm like, oh, Dad, I'm so sorry. Hey, wait a minute. How did you find out? You're in India. He goes, you're in every newspaper in India. My son's a star. And for the first time, like, he got what I did for a living, and it took me getting arrested. But he was very, like, you know, it's not for a lack of trying. I will say that. You know, my parents are very much like, it's not that they haven't tried. It's like, yeah. You know, there are cultural differences, there are generational differences, but it's not for a lack of trying. I will say that.
Yeah. I want to get back to the campaign just because on, like, a very personal, like, specific level, because when I think about going on the road to cover anything, there's like zero glamour.
Yeah,
right. There's like none of it. And also, you are covering like one of the most like hated, controversial men at that time, at least within the election. But I'm number one interested to know how you even were called to be a part of that at CBS. Yeah. Like, there are so many reporters who would die to cover a campaign, to be a part of covering an Obama or a Clinton, maybe a Trump, I wouldn't know, but.
Every network does it differently. You know, there's a very stringent interview process, there are written tests, and you meet with all the higher-ups. CBS, like, sent out a note to the whole network saying, hey, we're looking for people to cover the campaign, we need embeds, and so you have people applying from, you know, hundreds
and
hundreds.
Explain what embeds means.
So embeds, what a network TV embed does, which is what I was, and there's five of them, one for every candidate. You are on the road for the entirety of the campaign. You're gone. You know, most of us give up our apartments. You are not, you know, you're not in touch with your friends or family, not really, because you're just on the road. You could be in 5 states in a day. Wherever the candidate is, you're there. And you're the beat reporter. You are the person that's supposed to know everything that's going on with the campaign. You're the first, you know, if Trump sends out a tweet calling Mika Brzezinski, some heinous thing, you're the person that's on the network waking up everybody being like, hey, this is a thing, you know? You're the front lines. And you're doing everything from radio to TV to your writing pieces. You're literally doing everything. It's exhausting, you know, there are no days off.
Yeah.
There's nothing, you're never, you know, it wasn't exhausting. It's like training for a marathon, in essence. The best, you know, it has the same reward of like, oh my God, I just finished a marathon, but you never want to do it again.
Mm-hmm.
So it was an incredible experience, and how it happened, that every network does it differently, but CBS, you know, they put out what was called a call for embeds, and, you know, they get applications from all over, of all experience levels, and they picked, I think, 6 or 7 of us,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, you take a written test, and, you know, on the written test, some of the questions were like, and you had 10 minutes to answer this, and you had no preparation. Name every Iowa caucus winner going back to 1980.
And did you know that?
No. Name every nominee of each party going back to 1964.
What?
Name every one of the running mates going back to 1964. Name every New Hampshire primary winner going back to 1980. I obviously knew enough. I got the job,
mm-hmm.
you know. But even when I looked at the test, I was like, okay, what is the next job application? You know, like some of them were easy. Like, what happened in 2000 for George Bush to become president. You know, stuff like that. But some of them were, you know, name how many senators are up for re-election every 2 years. How many House of Representatives are up for re-election every 2 years. And so some of them were, you know, anyway, and then you do a writing test, and I still remember when I got the call saying that I was one of the embed. Being a network embed is a very prestigious job.
Yeah.
You know, I think... You know, Edward R. Murrow like had his like the Murrow Boys, you know, like all that stuff. And there's a really famous book by Hunter S. Thompson called The Boys on the Bus from 1972 about the following campaign. And when you start the job, you're like hoping it'll be like the Hunter S. Thompson book, and it is nothing like that anymore. You know, with Twitter and all that stuff, it's just a different era now. But I'd never done national politics before. I was excited to be in the middle of this particular election because everybody was running for president. I mean, we forget, like, George Pataki ran for president, you know, Bobby Jindal, Jim Gilmore, you know, those are, like, you know, everybody decided that this year was the year. Even Mitt Romney considered running again. You know, we forget that this was the year that a lot of people decided that they were going to run for president.
Yeah.
And one way or another, whether Hillary Clinton won or whoever, this was a historic election. And for me, it was really exciting to be able to be part of that.
Yeah. So it wasn't like you were working at CBS and they were like, we're going
to... No, I was. I was a producer for CBSN.
Okay. So you were doing that and then you applied for to be an embed.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's right.
In the end, why do you think they chose you? Like, I'm just curious, even like in like a self-righteous way, like what was it about you?
I did a stand-up set. Okay. I'm kidding. That's a joke.
I wouldn't believe like, you.
I'm kidding. No, I honestly, that's a question for them. I'm grateful they chose me.
Mm-hmm.
I honestly don't know. There were lots of very qualified candidates. I wish I had a better answer than that's a question for them.
Yeah.
You know, when you have your podcast with the CBS execs, you know, I'm thankful
that's
they did.
That's a question for them.
You know. I'm very thankful they because there were a lot of very, very talented people that... were in that process, and I'm just, you know, thankful they picked me.
Yeah. So, did you like it?
That's a complicated question.
Okay, let's get into that, because that's really what I'm interested in knowing.
It's exhausting.
Mm-hmm.
Covering a campaign is exhausting, and when you are covering Trump in particular, you get your head into a bad place. And not because, you know...
What does that mean?
So, you go to a rally, and you're being booed as you walk in. I saw reporters getting thrown stuff at them. I had people, you know, I had stuff thrown at me. And when you're getting booed multiple times a rally and you're having five rallies a day, it could put your head into a bad place. The flip side of that is that you are the lead reporter on the most important story in the world. And so you are so, that part is very gratifying.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever you're doing, whatever you're writing, whatever TV hits are doing, whatever, that's what's most watched. You know, your story is leading everything that is happening in the news. And so that part was great. It's more complicated than you to like it or not. One of the things they tell you right at the top of the gig is when it's not the hardest part isn't doing the job; it's what comes after. And nothing compares to covering a campaign. Nothing you do afterward is anywhere near as rewarding. Nothing you do, no matter what you do, you could be elected Pope, and it's not going to be as rewarding as covering a campaign. Mm-hmm. With that being said, while you're actually in it, yeah, you know, you're not talking to your friends and family. You're not talking to, you know, you are not, whatever hobby, I would not be here right now if the campaign was happening. I would not be, you know, things like happy hours with friends, you're not doing that. And when that's, like, I'm on multiple basketball teams. I'm not any good, but those are very important things to me. You're not eating well. You are not, you know, you're not sleeping at all. And when, think about all the things that you enjoy doing in your life and remove them and dedicate your entire life to work. What would that do to your mental health? It wouldn't be good. So, and you combine that with the fact that you're covering someone who loathes you, who loathes your profession, who whips up thousands of people at every rally to, you know, come after you. And I was one of the only reporters of color covering the campaign. So when you put all that together in the giant crock pot of happiness, you know, like nothing good is going to come of that. With that being said, I look back on that and I say, I mean, my God, what an experience.
Yeah.
What an incredible time in my life.
Right.
And I'm so thrilled that I got to experience that, if that makes sense.
Yeah. You, something that you haven't mentioned yet was that something that people started to follow your reporting for was that you were literally dissecting, transcribing, like, everything that Trump was saying, and people were, number one, paying attention to that, but also, like, in a very diligent way, particularly, specifically on Twitter. And so I'm kind of interested to know, like, when did it get to the point where you were like, oh, this is something that people are catching on to, and this is something that I should continue to do?
You know, Trump, as some of you might know, has a unique way of speaking. And I recognized early on that he has a very unique verbiage. And so for every, while most reporters would focus on the A headline, you know, Mexicans are, you know, undocumented Mexicans are rapists and criminals. And that's your A headline, right? Or your B headline might be, you know, I don't know, you know, there were thousands and thousands of Arab Americans dancing on the rooftops after 9/11. At every speech, there's a C, D, E, F, G, H that would not get coverage. And I was like, wait a minute, that's kind of a thing. And on top of that, Trump would say things that were so unique to Trump. And so, and I was like, that's, and you couldn't, they were, they might have been hilarious. You just can't help but, like, you know, they should, people should know that he's saying this because this is just too funny not to spread. And a good example of this is my favorite example, actually. After he made that claim about the rooftop, you know, the very, very false claim that there were thousands of Arab Americans dancing on the rooftops of 9/11, of New Jersey after 9/11, he got a lot of blowback for that. And afterwards, you know, he, you know, of course he doesn't say, I was incorrect, I misspoke. He's like, oh, no, totally, that totally happened. And then he said this, and I think it was a couple weeks after he made the claim. He says, when I first said that, nobody believed me. Actually, some people believed me. You know what? Everybody believed me. And I was just like, what? You know, like, you know, right. One time he, no, but like there would be all these kind of things. One time there would always be people dressed like Trump at his rallies. People would show up dressed like him with the blonde wig and the suit. And one time he brings someone on stage that's dressed like him in front of probably like 5,000-10,000 people. And he says to him, are you married? The guy says, yeah, I'm married. My wife's right there in the front row. And he goes, she's satisfied. Yeah, I think so. And then Trump goes in front of thousands and thousands of people. Yeah, she's probably fantasizing that you're Donald Trump at night. And you're like, oh my God. Did he just say that? And it was, and you couldn't, that's not a front page headline, right? But you couldn't help but like, people should know that this is happening right now.
Definitely.
You know, and because I think that that was indicative of, you know, it said something about him. What it says about him could be, you know, could be for the rest of you guys to judge. But for me, it was like important that people knew, you know. For example, it was important to me every time he said that he was against the war in Iraq. You know, it was important for me to point out that he wasn't, not before it started. It was important for me to point out that he one time said, I think it was in Charlotte, North Carolina, that African Americans now have it worse than any period in history. No, you know, I don't think it's opinion to say that's not true. And that, but in that rally, that wasn't the top headline. But it was important for me to like put everything out there. Because as president, you are focused on not just one issue. Your everything you do affects every single issue, and so and with Trump in particular, it was something worth exploring every part of, and so that's how that came together.
Okay, I had another campaign related question, but I want to move on to something.
Okay,
you know, not that.
Okay,
anyways. I thank you for sharing all that because I think it's just like good to know on a personal level when you are traveling with someone, what is that like? Anyways, here's my next question. So now you are covering the intersection of politics and culture at the New York Times, and I want to say that it was never that I was not interested in politics. That certainly would not be true. But I think that after the election, I started to understand more about how people are reacting, what they're making, what they're saying, how people are sharing their thoughts, and how the songs that you didn't think were political or that weren't like outwardly political or like the meme that you just thought was funny, I don't think I really understood how political these things can be, whether it's through gender or body image or through policy. And so the intersection of like, or even take a play like Hamilton, which is obviously political, right? Like it's political because it's historic, but it's also political because of when Mike Pence goes to see Hamilton.
Well, just this week, did everyone here see the Hamilton music video that just came out yesterday?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
so they did
that was a very politically themed. It was a Hamilton mixtape video, mm-hmm. with Riz Ahmed and a bunch of other guys. But that's a great example. Hamilton is it's a political show. I mean, Obama saw it twice and then invited the cast of the White House to see it. When Mike Pence went to see it, you know, they addressed an audience member from the stage. That never happens. And in fact, there was a big debate that happened after the Hamilton cast. Addressed a departing Mike Pence. That guy, Mike Pence, paid for his ticket. Who are you to single him out like that? You know, is that a fair? That wasn't from Republicans. That was from people. Those are from broad people on Broadway. You know, and it's a very interesting discussion for sure.
So I want to know how do you define culture? And the reason why I ask that is because I think that we talk about culture in such an abstract way. But kind of how I was explaining it and how people react to politics and how people react as an offshoot of things that are done that affect them or affect their community around them, to me, that is culture, the things that are made and how people decide to express themselves. But to you, like, what does that mean?
I think a better way to look at it, what isn't culture, right? Everything is culture, you know? There's nothing that's not. Right, and the thing about it is like culture is everything. Culture is bigger than politics. Culture is everything, you know. But that's at a macro level, right? At a micro level, culture is film, TV, comedy, music, theater, you know, classical music, whatever. But culture is everywhere. Culture is a bigger part of our individual lives than politics is. And I would bet that a lot of your friends, a lot of my friends certainly. Spend more time thinking about culture, thinking about their favorite music, thinking about their favorite Netflix show, thinking about their favorite, their favorite movie they want to see. They think about that more than they think about politics. And that's because most people, right, and that's probably not the case with this crowd here, and certainly not the case for me, but a lot of people, people that don't work in media, people that don't work in journalism, people that work as teachers or accountants or whatever, they're just trying to get through the day. And they're doing their job during the day. And when they get home, they're just trying to pay bills. And at 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, they just want to turn on Netflix and unplug. You know, they're trying to pay their mortgage. They're trying to pay their college tuition or their kids' college tuition or whatever. They're not thinking about politics as much. If you think about it, this is a country of 330 million people. What's the highest rated cable news talk show? When Bill O'Reilly was on the air, he was getting, 5-6 million viewers? That means the vast majority of the country, 90%+, is doing something other than watching Bill O'Reilly. And Bill O'Reilly was the premier cable news host. Mm-hmm. So culture, is I personally, I don't mean to be flippant about this, but it's everything. It's a huge part of our lives. And when we talk about the intersection of politics and culture, here's something to think about when it comes to Trump. Trump, there has never been a president in history who has the pop culture crossover that Donald Trump does. Donald Trump hosted WrestleMania. He was in Home Alone 2. He, on his IMDb page, and one of you guys can fact check me on this, but I believe he has 25 or something acting credits. He literally has a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. He is currently, or was at least till a month ago, was literally while in office the executive producer of a primetime show. So in terms of culture, Donald Trump pervades every single part of our culture. And part of that is because he's very acutely aware of pop culture. We forget this, but during the campaign, he was beefing with Samuel L. Jackson over golf fees. This is a thing that happened. Literally, he was like, I don't know Samuel L. Jackson. I think Samuel L. Jackson said something about, I think it was cheating at golf. You know, I think he said that Trump cheated. And then Trump tweeted, well, I've never met Samuel L. Jackson, and blah, 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 blah. And then someone immediately tweeted a photo of Trump and Samuel L. Jackson together. But he, you know, in the early 90s, you know, and throughout the 90s, Trump was known for attending glitzy Broadway openings. He loved, at least before he got in the office, he loved the, you know, Hollywood culture. And he loved, you know, one of my favorite stories is... Herbert Muchamp, who was an old New York Times architecture critic, gave a terrible review to one of the Trump buildings. I think it was in Chicago. Trump's furious. So Muchamp says, okay, let's go talk about this. Why don't we go meet up at, I think it was MoMA. We'll go meet at the MoMA and we'll talk about this. I want to, you know, kind of hang out at the MoMA with you. Trump says, fine. And he shows up at the MoMA. And there is this, and he brings a stack of papers, and he wants to, you know, tee off on Muchamp, and this is in the mid 1990s. He wants to tee off on Muchamp for writing this terrible review. And there's this Donald Judd exhibit in the corner. It's like a table, whatever. And Trump thinks it's a dining table, so he puts his coat on it, and puts like a stack of books on it, and then proceeds to tee off on Muchamp. I mean, but that's Trump, you know. At times cultured, at times absolutely not cultured. But one way or another, he's everywhere. And one of the things I learned, you know, a journalist once told me recently, or someone said this recently, even if you're not covering politics, you're covering politics. If you're covering sports, if you're covering art, you're covering, you know, whatever you are covering, you're
really
covering politics.
Point. Exactly.
You know, and to me, culture kind of encompasses all of that. You know, whether it's Hamilton, you know, whether it's Kathy Griffin or Bill Maher saying the N-word, or whether it's, you know, it could be everywhere. Julius Caesar in the park, you know, just a couple weekends ago, mm-hmm. you know, we saw the big thing. You know, there's a lot. Culture is just encompasses all of that.
I want to know what you're actually, like, paying attention to in culture that you are enjoying at SOPAN, whether it's a...
Oh, enjoying.
Yeah, that you're enjoying and that you're really, that you're actually really liking.
This is the comedian in me. There's been this... Netflix has provided... a huge home for Netflix specials that did not exist in the past. Whether it's Hasan Minhaj, Rory Scovel, you know, there's a, you know, Louis, you know, I think Chris Rock has one coming out, Chappelle's had a couple. There are more opportunities for comedians than there ever have been for. One thing I definitely look for, and I don't know if I'm alone in this, and maybe this just comes from my being exposed to Trump for 24/7, 2 years, I'm looking for a break from Trump when I am watching TV or going to see a movie or going, you know, I would like nothing more than to just unplug from the world in which we live in. And I know that's like not great for a reporter to say, you know, but
I feel that way a lot of the times.
Yeah,
too.
Sure. I would just off. Like, you know, when I go home at night, I would love to just like, you know, even Handmaid's Tale, which is like this dystopian.
Has anyone watched Handmaid's Tale?
Yeah. Like, I remember seeing a whole bunch of Trump stories that were like, you know, wow, this is really like crazy. Wow, this is like, and I was like, okay, well, I'm gonna, you know, I need a pick me up show. Well, here, let's watch. I've heard Handmaid's Tale is pretty good. And I'm like, wow, that was a bad decision. But seriously, anything that kind of unplugs me from the day-to-day news, which is always just so, you know, angry or just so, you know, astonishing. You know, it's astonishing. Like when I saw the Mika Brzezinski tweet today.
Yeah.
You know, I
did. Everyone hear about that? If you didn't, it's okay. You can say okay.
Right. If you hadn't, Donald Trump teed off on Morning Joe, which is the MSNBC's morning show, and I don't remember the tweet, but he said something along the lines of "Crazy Joe." And I think Psycho Mika wanted to come visit me for 3 nights straight at Mar-a-Lago around New Year's. Mika was bleeding from her facelift. I said no. And even for someone who has been so exposed to Trump and so, you know, nothing really surprises me when it comes to Donald Trump after covering that campaign, even I was a little, like, astonished that, okay, really? You know? So for me, when I take in culture now, I like to just whatever can kind of keep me away from, at least for an hour or two, keep me away from that world.
Yeah. How much time do we have, Nicole? 10 minutes. Or what time is it? I'm sorry? 8:20.
I can do 10 more minutes of stand-up if you guys want. I'm kidding, guys.
I want to take a 10-minute break, and after that, we're going to get to the plus one segment, which I'll talk more about. But until now, I think we should take a good break. Everyone should go get a drink if they would like one, and then we'll come back. Yay. I can't forget to do. I'm just making a mental note. I can't forget my thank yous at the end.
Okay.
So Pan, don't let me forget that. Alrighty. So I have one segment in my podcast. It's called the Plus One segment, and this is literally why my podcast exists, because it is a designated, purposeful time for myself and the guests to shout out a person, place, thing, or experience that they are loving right now. So there was a period of time where I would literally get on my own podcast and I would go, I don't really have anything. I shouldn't be doing that. I need to be like preparing in this way. Sometimes you just like go through dark times where you're just like, this feels like a little more than what I could muster through, but I've got one for my live show. But you are the guest. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Someone gets it. Thank you. You're the guest, so I want to know what your plus one is.
So when you, what does that mean? When you say plus one, what does that mean exactly?
It's like something that you're really appreciating right now. So it could be a person, a product, an app, a TV show.
Sure. Okay. As I think about this, this is a really good time for theater. This is a really interesting time this is the best, for example, this is the best Broadway has been in some time, and not just because of Hamilton, because of, you know, Dear Evan Hansen was a show that is, you know.
Are you like a Broadway buff? Like, you like going to theater?
Well, it's part of my job now.
Mm-hmm. Okay,
you know, true. No, fair. I don't mean that as, you know, I don't mean that as, you know, to be flippant. I mean that that's what part of the, one of the best parts about getting to do what I do is that whether it's music or comedy or whether it's theater, I get to take in a lot of performance now. And I've never had the appreciation, even though I grew up as a musician and grew up, you know, I've been doing comedy for a while and I've done musicals. And when I say I've done musicals, I mean I've been like Cowboy Number 3 in Howell High School's performance of, you know, 42nd Street. You know, I have never, you know, I've never had the chance to, you know, as part of my job, to take in as much performance. But even if you talk to Broadway, people that have been theater buffs for a long time, they will tell you that before Hamilton came along, there was this kind of drought of culture, you know, this drought of life-changing musicals, right? There hadn't been a Wicked in a while.
At least not on Broadway.
Not on Broadway, sure.
Where people, you could come to New York and be like, I'm going to see this play.
Right.
And you don't know.
And
the
Hamilton kind of changed the game. Hamilton changed it for, aside from becoming a cultural phenomenon, it was one of the few theater, few Broadway shows that had lots of people of color in it. And it showed that you didn't have to be. And there's actually a funny show that's a block away from Hamilton called Spamilton, which mocks Hamilton. But one of the points it makes as part of its parodying is that, like, you know, Hamilton showed that you don't have to be, like, have these show tunes like Oklahoma or Annie Get Your Gun or, you know, any of those shows. But beyond theater, you know, I'm just, on a daily basis, I'm wowed by the quality of the art that we're surrounded by, whether it's at museums or whether it's in comedy, whether it's in music. You know, I just happened to be, you know, just scrolling through YouTube, and I was watching Janelle Monáe at Glastonbury, which I don't remember what year that was. It might have been 2 years ago. And she's just incredibly talented. Or it could be, you know, one of the greatest bands I've ever seen live, Dave Matthews Band. And it could be just it was amazing, you know. This culture job and being able to write about it has been a great reminder to me that art and culture provides a great avenue for you to unplug. And after covering the Trump campaign for as many years, you know, as long as I did from start to finish, and being one of like 5 to 10 people to do that, being able to unplug is something I wasn't able to do in that time, and I have never appreciated it more than I'm able to now.
All right, so my plus one is actually Jessica Williams, Jessica Williams.
Great, great podcast. She has a wonderful podcast.
She has a wonderful podcast with Judy Robinson.
I just saw her. She did a show in Brooklyn with a bunch of people, and it was a reading of, I think it was The Real Housewives of...
oh, my God.
I don't know Real Housewives very well, but I still found the show very funny. They literally just transcribed an episode of a Real Housewives show, and they just read lines from it. It was very funny.
What? So it was Jessica Williams and who else?
A bunch of... Jessica Williams was the most well-known name. Like, there's a couple other... I don't remember the other comics on the panel.
So... The reason I say Jessica Williams is because I don't really know if I'm supposed to say this or not, but she's a member here, so I see her here. Number one, she does amazing work. She's formerly of The Daily Show. Mm-hmm. And she has a movie, I believe it's a movie coming out called Being Jessica James. And I am so excited. Yeah, I'm so excited for her. I think it's really cool to... see people, I think specifically black women, who don't feel like they need to hold on to these really cool, amazing jobs and realize, I don't need you, number one. And number two, I have a Netflix show. And I think I'm also I'm so excited to see this show because Jessica Williams is like, I want to say maybe 26, 27 years old. And...
yes, I'm unaccomplished. I get it. Okay. All right. Fine. Okay.
It's like, jeez. Yeah, that. Right. Damn it, Jessica Williams. But also, it's like, I have not seen a mainstream show that is going to cover a black girl in her 20s, like in the U.S.
Thank you. Insecure. Yes. Which starts, no, I believe, on July 23rd, right?
No, no. Let me. No. No.
No. Okay.
Because Issa Rae, Insecure is all about. Two black girls who are in their 30s. Issa doesn't have it together. Molly kind of has it together. And actually, I'm sorry. Both of them have it together and don't have it together in like the completely opposite ways, right? Issa Rae is like, oh my God, I'm going down a rabbit hole. I'm like,
so
oh, she's in a relationship.
How long is
the
podcast,
like, no, she's
by the
not.
Way?
Because this is about to become a conversation. But like, to me,
I'd be curious to hear. In all seriousness, I'm a huge fan of Insecure. I'm just curious.
Oh no, I am absolutely a fan of Insecure. But like, what this resurgence of a show and of lots of shows. Atlanta's and Empire's and Insecure, all three shows that I absolutely love and adore. Insecure is the story of black women who are coming into their 30s, mm-hmm. and starting to like find themselves and have experienced their 20s and have, they've already done that. And I'm really interested in a show that is about a black girl in her 20s.
You want a coming of age story.
Yeah, I want like a coming of age story of a 20 something year old woman. And I don't know if being Jessica James is going to deliver that, but I'm really interested in that story. You also take someone like Andrea Lewis, who, does anyone know who Andrea Lewis is? She was on Degrassi. Love her. She's someone who is like also creating these shows that have to do with black girls who are, they're not stuck in a job that they hate yet, or in a place where they're like, I don't know, trying to make it to some other level. They're in their 20s and they're like figuring shit out. And so I'm interested to know if Jessica James is going to be that. And so I'm really, really excited because we don't have a show that is on like a mainstream platform like that yet. However, I do want to shout out Brown Girls, which Brown Girls, see, you ain't hear about this. I'm about to put you on.
I was like, Brown about Girls, to disappoint a lot of people right now.
Brown Girls is a show that is kind of like a mini series that started on Vimeo, yeah, and in Chicago about two roommates. One of them is, I don't specifically remember where exactly she is from the Middle East, but she's from the Middle East, and then she also has a black friend, and so that was very much like two girls in their 20s who are like, they're partying, they're like, you know, they haven't like gotten out of that phase of their life yet where they're like extra tired, even though I'm like always extra tired. Anyways, yeah, so like that is a show that's actually was picked up at HBO that I'm really excited about, but I'm super fascinated and I want to relate to a show in
Is there a show that you feel like you relate to? I mean, that's a question for anybody. I'm just curious.
Yeah. Is there a show that I feel like I relate to?
The guest has become the questioner.
I know. Wait, I need to think about this. There has to be something.
And I mean, not to commandeer the podcast. Please feel free to chime in.
I love questions.
Because this is an interesting discussion, right? Because there has been. How many think pieces have you read about the lack of, you know, not just African American, but lack of minority representation on television, right?
I feel seen and insecure.
I was gonna say, do you feel like insecure? Do you feel like that's telling your story?
Not really. I feel like I have my shit more together than both Issa and Molly. I do, but like but romantically, I do feel like it tells a part of my story, if not not all of it, but some of it. Oh, maybe at another point in my life, not now.
Go on.
I don't know. So I'm trying to think of like a show that but I like, really
okay,
relate
but
to.
But here's the thing. So Issa's character is one of the things I find interesting about the show is that it really has an interesting way of conveying how white people view her and how, white, you know,
yes,
in the way
that's
that
one of the big
in
parts of it.
Right. I mean, there are so many scenes of her at work.
Yeah.
You know, at her nonprofit that she works at. And these are white people, in essence, white-splaining to her about what African-American kids at school will want.
That's like,
and do you feel like you deal with that, that they conveyed that in the way that you deal with it on, you know?
I don't feel like they, I am happy to say that I don't feel like I experience that currently at BuzzFeed News. Mm. I'm happy to say that. But I also want to say that I don't work with white dudes all day at BuzzFeed News. Thank you, Manu. I really appreciate your like, I like appreciate you as like my hype man right now. So, I mean, my boss is Middle Eastern. My coworkers are like people of color. So I actually don't feel like I do. And if I did, I'd probably quit because my tolerance is so low for bullshit. But I'm trying to really think of a show, even if it's not one that's currently on, that I really, really relate to. Give me 5 seconds.
It's your podcast, not mine.
I know. I know that there has to be one. Oh my gosh. What's one of my favorite shows of all time?
But I mean, this in itself is interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, the fact
like
that we have to stretch this much, right?
I can't think of one.
I mean, in terms of Indian journalist stand-up comics, there are not many shows for people like me.
I mean, do people ever tell you look like Inzi Zanzari? Just kidding.
Yeah, I do. I get that a lot. Every time I do a set, no, I do get like, oh my God, you're just like Aziz. And I'm like, I'm not. I'm not at all. There's right, like, there's nothing, you know, there's nothing at all like me about Aziz.
I cannot think of a show right now. Maybe I'll follow up. One that relates to me and who I am. Maybe something like A Different World back in the day. But I actually did really enjoy Girls. I will confess and say that. I did really like Girls.
And why is that?
I think it was the New York element. I think that even though that's another show, I felt like I had my shit together more than any of the cast or any of
the
characters.
It's a low bar, I mean, if we're being honest.
Yeah, no, it's quite a low bar. Yeah. Broad Cities, quite a low bar.
Yeah. Right.
But I will say that those are two shows that like did not have many people of color in them. But I did relate to like the conversations, and they did make me laugh, and I understood what they were going through because of where they were in their lives, and because
so
I
you
felt
relate
like
to as a young person less, you know.
Yeah,
more so.
Yeah. So, but so many times, what I will tell you is that so many times I have been at dinner with friends, and we'll have some sort of conversation where I'll be like, "This could be a scene in a show right now," mm-hmm. And I'm sure so many of you have experienced that too, where it's like. You'll say something. It doesn't even have to be about a guy. Maybe it's sometimes just about like how you're feeling at work. And you're like, we might as well just shoot a show right now. You know? Mm-hmm. But you know,
you take out your phone with a camera out and
that's what we should be doing. But anyways, Jessica Williams is my plus one. I'm really excited to see that show. Even if it's not what I hope it will be, I still am so confident it'll be brilliant. And I'm so interested and excited for all the things that she's doing. We need to actually get her on this podcast. So, yeah. I don't know. This is kind of how I wanted to end. I always end with this as my last segment of my podcast. So, Pan, thank you.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Before we end, there are some people who I wanted to thank. Obviously, So, Pan. We got 1245 over here, a.k.a. Erica, that has been, like, spinning all the jams tonight. I want to thank Ludlow House for having us here. I want to thank Nicole Garter, who's, like, the social media editor for my podcast and does so much more than that and has been helping me with, been my partner in crime in all of this. And I want to thank all of you for being here and supporting and for listening. All right. Yay! We out. Thank you. People be rolling.